This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Raymond DeYoung is an academic who isn't working for a military think tank or explaining why we should just keep climbing the consumer ladder. His localization reader will likely fall into hands that get dirty in gardens and active in your community. DeYoung is Associate Professor of Environmental Psychology and Planning in the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. Raymond, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here.
We have so much to talk about, but for openers, I'm curious, what made you choose a different direction away from supporting that great big corporate system?
Well, actually, to be honest, I started out as an engineer, so I was originally supporting an industrial society and for a number of years, but I got more involved in the people side, on planning for people, getting them involved in participation programs. Anybody who's ever worked with public participation programs know that there are guaranteed way to make everybody unhappy, the public and the experts alike. And so I was interested in figuring out how to do that better. Went back to school and got a PhD in environmental psychology and planning, where I was studying, you know, the conditions under which you can bring out the best in people. How can we draw people into conversations where they feel like they're contributing something meaningful, and how do we get the kinds of information we need as experts to help manage the world better? And that got me just involved in behavior change research and of all sorts of psychology on how the mind interacts with the world. And it's just been an incredibly lucky change, because I'm having more fun these days than I would have ever had I stuck with my early career.
And, you know, I came upon your work through the psychologist Carolyn Baker. She passed on an article of yours about how to survive our knowledge about this society under extreme stress with a technique as simple as a walk in the park or something like that. Tell us about that, would you?
Well, and part of that's a foundational aspect of how to bring out the best in people. To understand why a walk in the park, or actually any interaction with nature, works, you have to understand how the brain evolved to deal with information. I don't want to belabor the point here, but there's some technical stuff, and there's two kinds of attention that people have and use every day. One kind that we're using right now is called directed attention. It's where we voluntarily focus our attention on certain aspects of the environment, of our interactions socially or physically with the environment, and it's a tool that allows us to shut down distractions or competing information or thoughts so that we can stay true to our conversation or our plan or our activity. Now, unfortunately, that kind of attention, this directed attention that we're all using right now, tends to fatigue. It wears out at the end of a long day at work or end of a hard week of work, and the result is an irritability, an inability to concentrate, a tendency to think more simply about things, not go below the surface. There is another kind of attention. It's an older form, or what they call in psychology a less derived form of attention, and it's called involuntary attention or involuntary fascination. And it's the kind of attention that draws the mind to the environment without effort. So it's at work when we're noticing a bright object in the environment or something that's moving very quickly or a loud noise. So if you find yourself deep in thought, and you're crossing a street, and then suddenly there's a loud horn, and you immediately turn toward the truck coming towards you, that's involuntary attention working. It doesn't fatigue. It continues to work time after time. You can imagine that it has a large number of evolutionarily significant aspects. It protected us. It continues to protect us. It also has another side to it, which is it's not just loud noises and moving things, shining things, bloody things that grab our attention, although Hollywood and advertising is one of that. It also, our involuntary attention is drawn to nature. It's drawn to water flowing. It's drawn to large trees. We're drawn to the wind moving the leaves around. And so there's a gentler or a softer kind of fascination. And that's where this whole idea of walking through nature comes from. If we need to restore our directed attention, the attention we use in a lot of our everyday work world or socializing, then we need to rest. We need to not use it for a while. Now, a good nap will help, but even better, it turns out, is to get into an environment that's filled with involuntary attention. So if you get into nature where there's just a lot of water flowing or gentle wind or you're out in a field with rain flowing in the wind, using involuntary attention to a large degree and allowing the directed attention to restore itself. Now, there'll be a little bit of directed attention necessary to navigate, you know, to not walk into a tree, but so little that you can really think of that as an environment where your mind can rest. And so in the modern world, we spend a lot of time in environments where there's a lot of information, a lot of distractions, a lot of fascinating distractions that just keep grabbing our attention. We have to use directed attention a lot more than our ancestors may have. Plus, in that environment, in the modern environment, there's a lot less access to nature around the corner or just around yourself. Again, our ancestors, if they had to restore themselves, they didn't have very far to go. Probably they were already out in nature or they were very close to it. So we're not only in a situation that taxes directed attention much more than it used to, we're also in environments that are devoid of the involuntary fascination stimuli that help us to restore directed attention. So we have to be a little bit more planful, a little more intentional about our restoration. And I think one of the best ways of doing it is walking more. Because walking, if you can make sure you pick a route that's through nature, through a tree-lined street, or through a couple of gardens or a local park, the moments you're there are going to be a little bit more restorative than if you had chosen the other route, which would have been a little bit busier or louder or more urban in nature.
I've got to agree. You know, I use that technique every day. I walk among some trees or along a little stream near our house. And without that, with all the bad news I get about peak oil and climate change and the economic situation, I couldn't survive without that. Now, I've been thinking about another one of your concepts that you've proposed, which is muddling through. It's pretty apparent most people's lives are not going to be changed by academic papers or even a radio show host like me. Millions of people are already facing difficult choices about what to do. How will they muddle through it?
Well, I think there's two ways of doing that. They have no choice but to muddle through, because we don't already know the answers to things like peak oil or climate disruption. We know the problem, and we know what's likely to happen, but I think it would be incredibly arrogant of us to say that we have the exact correct way of living. That kind of utopian thinking has never really worked well, because it doesn't stick. People don't function well. Plus, I think technically we're not entirely sure how to solve some of these problems. How do you solve a peak oil or an energy descent problem when for the last several hundred years we've been growing our energy use? And so, the thing that's going to be most important, actually, there's a colleague down in Yellow Springs, Ohio, Pat Murphy, who says we have to make a lot of mistakes quickly. And by that he means we have to do a lot of experiments. We have to try lots of new things. We have to, each of us, take on sort of an experimental view of our everyday behaviors, our choices, our interactions with other people. We have to support that kind of experimenting, exploring in our society. So we have an explorer, you know, basically a exploring society. I like to think of it as behavioral entrepreneurship. You know, I'm sure you've heard of social entrepreneurs and certainly business entrepreneurs, but behavioral entrepreneurs are people who are trying to invent new ways of interacting and new ways of making choices. Since there isn't any master plan, and we can hardly expect that the powers that be, whether they be large corporations or large governments, are going to be able to help here. Because in many ways, this is a very different model from what we've all grown up to expect. We're going to have to try lots of things, and if we're really experimenting, some of them will fail. If they fail, we're going to have to be able to pick ourselves up and start again. So that idea of muddling, of trying, of being honest about what's working and what's not, and just moving on to the next experiment is important. I think if we can support people and individually, as individuals or as families, as neighborhoods, and support the people who are trying experiments, it's going to be easier for them to try more radical experiments. Because nobody likes to fail, certainly nobody likes to fail publicly. So although we do need these people experimenting radically, so put that all together, we have to support these small experiments going on all around us.
Well, it makes me wonder, though, why is society so hard on those people who do try different ways of life and experiments? It seems like we're almost trying to stop that from happening.
It's a good question. I don't think I have a great answer to that. I think perhaps our society has modern society, modernity, has put a very big amount of attention on success, on winning, rather than on trying and exploring. So I imagine in the early days of the development of industrial society, when lots of new things were being tried, lots of new experiments were going on, those people may not have always been treated as crackpots, as strange people. They were the modern people. But somehow in the meantime, we put such a high price on winning. You can't fail. You can't let this next quarterly report show any kind of a downturn. That it's very hard for people to start becoming behavioral entrepreneurs, trying new things. And so I think what we have to do is start to change that norm. Now, norms change very slowly. We have to do it through our own experiences. So in some ways, starting with young children and letting them know that it's okay to try things that don't work. You're not supposed to perform perfectly. So I think the educational system has begun a good number of decades ago. We begin to understand that. And so we have a lot more tolerance for children learning at their own rate, trying new things, exploring things with no need that it has to be coloring inside the lines sort of a thing. But I think it's because we've built a society that wins. And, of course, there's any one society that has done incredibly well over the last century. It's the U.S. society. Modern, modernity really evolves out of sort of a Western industrial mindset, and we're certainly in the middle, in the core of that. So it may be here that it's hardest to get experimenting. It's interesting to think about things like the transition town movement, which started in the U.K. I mean, it's certainly taken off in the U.S., but it didn't start here. It started over in Europe, and in some ways, it may be that it's in the periphery of industrial imperial society that we'll see some of these more interesting, more deep explorations going on. There's somebody in your area of the woods, Karen Lifton, University of Washington, who studies eco-villages, which are another example of some of the experimenting that's going on. You know, we had the whole commune movement back in the 60s and 70s. It didn't really take hold in most of the country anyway.
I was there.
me too. I was there, and I'm really sorry it didn't take hold. But the new version is eco-villages, both eco-housing, but also co-housing, but also just the whole village version of that. And her book on eco-villages is just inspiring, and it's the examples of people muddling through and trying how to craft neighborhoods, trying how to interact in very different social ways while continuing to live in modern society. So it's not a back to the land movement only. It's not giving up all aspects of a modern society. So they're not rejecting all modern institutions. They're just reorienting, retasking, right-sizing those institutions.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are talking with Raymond DeYoung from the University of Michigan, co-author of The Relocalization Reader. I'm Alex Smith. Well, good. Well, let's talk about your new book coming out with Thomas Prinsen, and it's about relocalization. Would you tell us about that? Introduce us to this book.
Well, I can't help but start it by saying Tom and I have been colleagues for decades, and we meet for coffee at least a few times a week, usually in a small courtyard on our campus where we hide out for a while, and we've been having conversations about peak oil and climate disruption and consumption and environmental problems. The psychology of it is my side, and he does the institutions. And about, maybe 10 years ago, we got on to the peak oil literature and began to try to understand that, how it would affect it. And to understand what localization is about is we had both assumed, and I think most people do, that the challenge we're facing is trying to get people to live more environmentally sustainably, that it was going to be us, experts, practitioners, programmers, NGOs, that would initiate the change, and it would bring people to a more greener, leaner lifestyle. And when you step back and look at things like climate disruption, peak oil, energy descent scenarios, you begin to realize that we're not going to have to get people to consume less resources. They're going to be consuming less resources, whether they're ready or not, whether they're prepared or familiarized with the new life or not. And that's a subtle change, but it means that we're not going to have to motivate them to change. We're not going to have to persuade them to live green. They're not living that way now, perhaps, but soon now, circumstances will change such that they will be consuming less resources. And what they're going to want from us is advice, us being experts and practitioners and teachers and educators. They're going to want advice on how to respond, how to deal with an energy descent scenario drawn out over a long period of decades. And that's what localization is. It's a process by which you begin to get people's minds turned around, simpler lives and all, not because it'd be good for them, but because they don't have any choice. Now, it's not anti-globalization. It's not saying right off that we're trying to create a new movement that's against globalization, although it very much is the opposite of globalization. It's also not just about the local, about a kind of hyper-localism. It's instead a process that goes on at many different levels in society that turns our attention more and more toward local systems. I think the local foods movement is a great example. You know, it didn't come from on high. It wasn't started by corporations or by governments, started by local folk. But it's not just about local food. It's about systems, about communication, about philosophies of food. And there's a lot of sharing that goes on regionally and nationally and internationally about this issue. So localization has some of those international, regional aspects to it. It's a little different than just, you know, a localist approach. It also argues that this kind of a challenge, a challenge that's going to involve a lot of that behavioral entrepreneuring that I talked about a moment ago, it's going to bring out the best in people, because people do well when they're challenged. They do well when their choices, their behavior matters. And this is going to be a situation where what you do, how you interact with your neighbors, how you prepare your family to live, how you prepare your family's budget to function over this energy descent is meaningful. It's real. It's genuine. And so in some ways, this is going to be an absolutely great opportunity for the human mind, because it's well adapted to this kind of problem solving. I don't think that the human mind is well adapted to affluence. We don't seem to be doing very well with it. But it is. It did evolve through millions of years of dealing with these kinds of challenges. So localization actually has an aspect to it about a positive psychological well-being that sort of emerges out of this issue. You know, it lets people have a more fulfilling, more meaningful life at the same time that they're living with ecological compatibility.
Well, let's talk, too. You said you've written an article called Adapting to the Coming Downshift, but I'd like to be clear, what do you mean by a downshift?
Well, we tried to think of a term that's better than collapse, because there's a great book by Joseph Tainter called The Collapse of Complex Societies, where he outlines 16 or 17 different past civilizations that went through collapse, and finds that it's not an odd occurrence in human history, and there's no reason to believe that modern industrial society won't follow a similar trajectory. He uses the term collapse, but he actually is describing something called a great simplification, a dropping down to a much lower level of societal complexity. That's one aspect. We wanted to use a word that's different than collapse and try to find one word. And so downshift was one of the words we played with. We imagine driving an automobile and, you know, you have to slow down. So what do? You downshift. You shift to a lower gear. You're not collapsing to a lower speed. You're going at the speed that's appropriate. You're choosing the gear, the pace that's appropriate for that circumstance. Downshifting is that notion, which is it's going to be very important to come up with a slower, less energy-intense, material-intense pace of life. That's going to be what is compatible with the planet, compatible with sustainable existence. And so it's more of a downshift than a collapse. We also think of it as the downshift moment. It's the moment when people wake up or finish reading something or end a conversation and realize that they now see the world differently. That's what happened with us when we started talking about energy descent and other aspects of resource constraints, sort of an old limits to growth thinking coming back again. Tom Prinsen and I both started out reading The Limits to Growth back in 1972, and here we are talking about it again. But the downshift moment is where you sort of internalize that. You realize this is different. It's going to require that I train myself, I teach my children, I interact socially in a very different way. And when you get to that moment, that kind of a downshift moment, it's hard to look at the world the same way. You'll see things that might have bothered you before as being very wasteful. And you realize, well, that's just not going to last much longer. There's just no way that that's sustainable. That'll be ending. And you begin to also see other things going on that you hadn't perhaps noticed in the same way. Side yard or backyard gardening, people, you know, helping each other, fix-it shops, all kinds of, you know, if you will, somewhat lower-skilled activities, but where the people involved are reskilling themselves in old ways, learning old skills and modernizing those old skills. So again, in the food movement, you can see all the people involved in food preparation and preserving, and you know, all the excitement that goes on in that. It's a good example of how, you know, that's not simply a bunch of people looking for a hobby. It's the beginning of localization. And those people have gone through, we think, or it would be very easy for them to go through a downshift moment. So downshifting is both a process of adjusting your pace, right-sizing your pace to the planet, but also it's a moment, a mental shift.
As we get close to wrapping up, I'm hearing from you that this is something that might happen in the minds of millions of people, and then governments and corporations may play a catch-up role later. Is that what you're saying?
Very much so. I don't even know that all of them are going to be able to catch up, because some of what the change involves is just to move to a whole different arrangement. So it's possible that some industries, some corporate mission statements will simply make little sense. I mean, under an energy descent scenario, a number of things change. You have far less mobility, far less international finance. You perhaps have far less, if you will, entertainment, far less purchasing of services, and you begin doing for yourself more. You begin spending much more time provisioning for yourself, your family, your neighborhood. You're more likely to interact with people. So some industries, the entertainment industry, the transportation industry, the finance industry, may find it difficult to adapt. They may have to dramatically modify themselves. Others may find clever ways of localizing. I'm sure they're all clever people, and they'll try to do it. But in some cases, catch-up is possible for only some of them. And again, it's not like, well, this may or may not be desirable. I don't know. I never got involved in the whole environmental globalization debate. It just was something that wasn't part of my working on behavior change and the psychology of simple living. So I really don't have a strong position on, I never had a strong position in my writing or my research on globalization. But this is likely to change all of that, not by choice, but just by circumstance.
You know, I think we could talk for an hour, and I think we should at some point. Right now, we've got to wrap it up. Our guest has been Raymond DeYoung, Associate Professor of Environmental Psychology and Planning from the University of Michigan. Look for Localization Reader from MIT Press. Raymond, thank you for joining us, and let's do talk again.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I trust your life will never be the same. It's all changing, my friend. Set your clocks for a future not advertised on TV. Our background music was provided by Vast Mandana. Find more links in the show blog at ecoshock.info. Don't forget our website, ecoshock.org. Tune in next week, and please tell your friends about this program before it's too late.